In the studies of the book of Matthew, and today it's chapter 5, beginning at verse 21. If you want to follow in the blue book in front, it's page 5 in the New Testament section. Or you can follow overhead, of course. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment." But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, "You fool," you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are in the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you've paid the last penny. You have heard that it was said, "You should not commit adultery." But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. It was also said, "Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce." But I say to you, this is Jesus speaking, that anyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you've heard it said to those of ancient times, "You shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord." But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer, but if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For you love those who love you. What reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. These difficult words of Jesus are the word of God.
Yes, quite the text this morning. I had hoped to find a joke to kind of break the ice, but I didn't find anything that would work. This is a long text, and I had thought about dividing it up, but it is designed to be read as a whole. It consists of 6 units, each one introduced with Jesus saying, "You have heard it said, but I say to you." Jesus takes the commands of the law and shows how they give us a blueprint, a way of being gloriously human. These are not theological statements of general ethical principles, but examples of how Jesus views a life lived the way God intended, and how that is worked out in practice. N.T. Wright notes, "This new way which Jesus has come to pioneer and make possible goes deep down into the roots of personality and produces a different pattern of behavior altogether. Throughout this chapter, Jesus is not just giving moral commands. He's unveiling a whole new way of being human. In these six units, contrast is made with the ethical rules that were previously accepted, moving them into a way that's far more demanding and reaching. The tendency was, and the tendency can still be, toward a legalistic, external obedience to the law. But Jesus is calling attention to an inner obedience from the heart. Jesus begins with discussing the issue of murder, noting that this begins with anger inside someone. Jesus goes behind the act of murder itself to declare the anger and hatred that give rise to it. It's not that you just, you know, kind of stop yourself before killing someone, but that you wouldn't even get to that point of thinking that you wish someone were dead. He goes even farther to look at the way that we express ourselves, not to use any insulting language, as these words then suggest an angry contempt. Just beyond are two houses that we have next door here where we run a ministry for refugee claimants. There's an apartment complex. And because street parking around the church here is only for 2 hours and we're supposed to be in the office all day, right? We have rented a couple of parking stalls over there. Well, they recently installed a gate to kind of the main parking area, and our stalls are now just kind of outside of this gated area. This change was done recently, and then there was one gray car that kept being in one of the stalls. And one day after work, I walked over there, and I saw the person who owned this car and respectfully just mentioned, you know, just so you know, we have reserved these stalls. Well, I received quite the expletives from this young lady. Went into quite a little tirade. Then she went into the complex, and then a couple more minutes came out, more expletives. And then made a comment she was moving out in a few days. I responded appropriately, just so you know. But I sure wondered, where was all that anger coming from? Maybe she was even kicked out of the apartment there because of outbursts of anger. Insulting language is an expression of anger. And escalating anger has all sorts of ramifications. Jesus is directive. It's not merely to just avoid abusive expressions. That would be just another form of legalism. Rather, it's submitting our hearts, our thoughts about others, as well as then the words that they give rise to. It's getting to the core. When we let anger for someone burn inside us, we become less than gloriously human. When we reach the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we will see the warnings that Jesus gives for the result of not dealing with anger. The result is disaster. As you look at the world around us, all the global issues that are going on these days, what do you see as an outworking of anger? All sorts of devastation. This past Tuesday, I attended a lunch with two gentlemen from the International Justice Mission. And Peter shared with us a couple of weeks ago how we voted at our AGM to begin a partnership with IJM, the International Justice Mission, specifically in regards to the Dominican Republic. And this is very exciting. And we will continue to bring you updates and prayer requests about this. But during our lunch conversation, Mark Wallenberg commented, "The root cause of poverty is violence." I really hadn't thought about that before. And he mentioned that in trying to help with issues like addressing poverty, if you don't deal with violence, you'll continue to have problems. Violence destroys lives and blocks the road out of poverty. In a book and a video that we have in the library called The Locust Effect, the statement is made, like a horde of locusts, violence devours everything in its path. Jesus offers us an alternative. Two practical commands: be reconciled and make friends. Sounds simple, but it can be very difficult and costly. It means you have to surrender your position of authority over the person that you are angry with. Colossians 3:8 says to be rid of anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. And James 1:20 says that our anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. And Jesus unfolds this further by giving an illustration that stresses the importance of reconciliation, of not holding on to anger and grudges. In these teachings of Jesus, there's an exaggeration to make a point. In verse 23, Jesus describes someone coming to the temple, buying an animal to sacrifice on the way, and then suddenly remembering a relationship that has gone wrong. And if you think about the people to whom Jesus was talking, they were from Galilee. For a person from Galilee to get to the temple would have taken about 3 days. So most likely, Jesus is not describing someone coming to worship, leaving an animal, a live animal, sitting there in the temple courts for a week while they scurried home, apologized to the offended person, and then returned back to Jerusalem. Several commentators noted that the scene becomes almost comic. Jesus seems to be exaggerating to bring home the point. The point is that we are to live day by day in such a way that when we come to worship, there is no anger between us and others. Jesus wants us, as his followers, to live radically reconciled lives. Jesus reveals that the intent of the law is to nurture relationships. And his followers are to have a daily urgency for maintaining and developing the healthy life of relationships. The next area that Jesus addresses is adultery. Jesus expected his followers to be marked by greater righteousness, by holiness and love. And this includes our sexuality. Adultery was considered one of the most serious offenses because it broke the relationship that was a reflection of God and his people. When two people get married, they become one. Sexual union creates a permanent bond. Adultery automatically then annuls a marriage by creating a new sexual bond in its place. And adultery, like murder, is defined at a deeper level. As murder begins with anger, adultery begins with lust. So Jesus states that the first thing to deal with is lust. Jesus is not putting down desire, but desire that's spent wrongfully. And Jesus again goes to the extreme in order to impress on his followers the seriousness of the sin. Cutting your hand off or plucking out your eye are deliberate exaggerations, like leaving an animal on the altar for a week while you go off to be reconciled. Early in church history, there were some who wrongly took the sayings here literally. Jesus is not advocating physical self-mutilation, but through dynamic figures of speech, indicating the kind of rigorous self-discipline that committed followers will display. He indicates the avoidance of temptation and that may involve drastic sacrifice. Jesus then goes on to talk about divorce. And at that time, permissible grounds for divorce were debated, but it was also very easy to obtain a divorce. One school of thought restricted it to a sexual misdemeanor that was authenticated by witnesses. And I thought, well, yeah, that's an interesting task. Hide behind the curtain. And the other school thought that divorce could occur for any kind of complaint, even, you know, burning the dinner meal. No court decision was required, only a one-sided action by the husband. Jesus is firm how he feels about divorce. And notice this discussion comes between two other issues, anger and lies on one hand, and lust on the other. And one author noted, divorce normally happens when lust and lies have been allowed to grow up like weeds and choke the fragile and beautiful plant of marriage. God's original plan in creation is that marriage be permanent. Marriage is a sacred, holy union created by God to make a man and a woman one flesh. As a result, divorce is always contrary to God's perfect design. Divorce today is so prevalent. You know, how many people, even when they get married these days, know that divorce will be an option? Sin is what destroys a marriage. And so divorce is permitted because of the hard-heartedness of people. What often happens when people look at this passage is kind of see, okay, what is it that we can get away with? What can I and can't I do? Later on in Matthew, Peter asked the question, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Jesus' response is, we're to always forgive. Peter wanted a rule. He wanted a certain amount and then, okay, yeah, no further. We do the same with divorce and all the other items that Jesus is talking about here. What we often do is take more of this legalistic stance. So, my divorce is okay because my husband was unfaithful? That is really not the point. What does it mean to live gloriously human lives in regards to marriage? It's not a focus of, well, what can I get away with? Or a place maybe where I can judge others. Hauerwas makes this astute comment. If we come to this text looking for reasons to justify divorce, we miss the whole point. What this text does is to redefine marriage and to anchor it in the new community of Jesus, a community that will make possible both single life and fidelity. Jesus calls his followers to a better way, to the way of love and marital faithfulness. Divorce is not what God would want for us. It hurts. It damages. No one comes out of it without being negatively impacted. The sin that caused the divorce, immorality, abuse, and so forth, yes, have to end. And in order to have that happen, a marriage may need to end. But all that pain certainly is not what the Lord desires for us. When we live gloriously human lives, anger doesn't escalate. Sexual indiscretions don't occur. It's getting rid of anger and lust. So there is honesty, respect, care, and forgiveness. We're not caught up in selfish ambition and hurtful actions. And then marriages can thrive the way God intended. Jesus goes on to deal with oaths, highlighting the need for us to be honest, how we're to be truthful in everything we say, following through. He then talks about the law of retaliation, condemning how that had been used to promote personal revenge. In the world of Jesus' day, the Jews were under the rule of the Roman occupying forces. So they began to use this law of retaliation to justify personal revenge. They were at the mercy of the Romans everywhere, on the street, on the court, even over finances. And the Jewish leaders had little or no power to execute justice. Those who were hurt wanted to strike back. So personal retaliation through violent resistance was a burning issue within the Jews. It's in this oppressive atmosphere that Jesus speaks this message. Even when they are being abused, they must think of ways to advance the kingdom of heaven and bring his influence to the earth. Jesus then uses four illustrations from the life of his disciples. I want to give you an illustration that I heard this past week. This past week, I had the privilege of co-chairing the ordination examining council for our denomination. We had 7 candidates go through, and it was delightful to hear from them. One of our candidates is Winston Pratt, who's part of the pastoral staff team at West Point Grey Baptist Church. Winston is from South Africa, and he shared a bit of a story of one time when he was in a church in South Africa, and there was a terrorist attack. The terrorists were opposed to the ethnic integration that was happening in the church and the reconciliation that was taking place. The terrorists came in throwing hand grenades and shooting with AK-47s. 10 people were killed. 40 to 50 people were wounded. Winston observed all this. And what do you think the response was? Anger? Retaliation? No. They reached out and they offered forgiveness. They responded the way that Jesus is advocating here, turning the other cheek, loving their enemies. So often we hear the phrase, I'm only human. And one man commented about this phrase saying, I typically say that after I've backed the car through the garage door, asked an unpregnant woman when her baby is due, or ruined a family dinner. He goes on to say, being human is typically associated with being imperfect. No matter how hard we might try to rise up, that buzzkill named gravity has a way of keeping us down. What is often absent from such a definition, however, is the glorious aspects of our humanity. Genesis 1:27 says that we are made in the image of God. And if we are made in the image of a glorious God, we were made, therefore, to embody glory. St. Irenaeus wrote, the glory of God is man fully alive. Throughout this chapter, Jesus is not just giving moral commands. He's unveiling a whole new way of being human, of being gloriously human. But how do we get there? How do we overcome the gravity of our flaws that rise up and flourish us as human beings? It may all seem a bit strange to us, but Jesus lived it and he invites us to follow him. He lived these radical principles and he became an example for us. We may think, this is not possible, but with Christ it is. He shows us and enables us to live gloriously human. Our focus is not to be asking, what are the rules? But on what it means to be gloriously human, alive and awake and wild with possibilities. Wherever we find ourselves, we need to ask, what would it mean to reflect God's generous love? Jesus' teaching here isn't good advice. It's good news. Jesus opened up the way of being human so that all who follow him can discover it. When they mocked him, he didn't respond. When they challenged him, he responded to them in ways to help them think differently. When they struck him, he took the pain. When they nailed him to the cross, he prayed for them. The passages that we have been looking at on the Sermon on the Mount are about Jesus. He asks nothing of us that he himself has not faced. The Sermon on the Mount is not just about how to behave. It's about discovering God and the love of Jesus. And then it's learning to reflect that love. We are called to a wholeness in Christ, a life that goes beyond legal conformity, to a life totally integrated to the will of God, reflecting his character. This morning, I think we can be encouraged and deeply challenged. Encouraged because this isn't a list of rules, and if you don't follow them, you know, you're out. But we can also be deeply convicted and challenged. Are we living lives that are pleasing to God? Are we gloriously human, reflecting humanity the way he intended? John Calvin wrote, "However difficult, arduous, troublesome, or painful God's rule may be, we must make no excuse for that, as the righteousness of God should be worth more to us than all the other things which are chiefly dear and precious." Jesus calls us to a life of holiness and love. The reality of the kingdom has come. And that means, for us as kingdom people, we begin to exhibit those kingdom qualities. As we end this morning, I want to leave just a bit of time and space to reflect, to allow God to kind of convict us of those places where we see, wow, we are just not living the way that he intended. And then to take those things, to bring them to him for forgiveness, receiving his grace, and ask for his help so that we can follow his best for our lives. I've asked the team just to play through the first verse instrumentally while we have a chance just to pray, and then we'll join in singing together.